It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This month marks 2 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled same-sex couples have a legal right to marry nationwide. The long and complex history of the gay rights movement is the focus of a project here in Georgia.
There are a lot of kids here, and if we catch you with a homosexual, the rest of your life will be a living hell.
The CBS News survey shows that 2 out of 3 Americans look upon homosexuals with disgust, discomfort, or fear.
They have struck down the portion of DOMA which would ban same-sex couples from getting the same benefits as traditionally married couples.
I want to welcome everyone to the first day of marriage in Georgia, first day of marriage in 13 states that have been denied it.
The LGBT Institute at Atlanta's Center for Civil and Human Rights tells the stories of the gay rights movement. I talked about the Institute in 2015 with Executive Director Ryan Romerman. We also heard from Tim M. West. He's a member of the Institute's programming board. Ryan, let's start with what is the purpose of the Institute itself and why it's at the Center for Civil and Human Rights?
Well, to start off with, the whole idea of the Center for Civil Rights is to talk about the American Civil Rights Movement and how it pertains to human rights movements around the world. And quite simply, you can't talk about human and civil rights without talking about LGBT rights. And so the community, when the center opened, was excited about, the LGBT community was very excited about the center opening, but it has also been clamoring for more of a role at the center itself. And so this is definitely a response from the community who want to make sure that LGBT discussions are happening at the center. So what we really want to do is provide a global platform to bring ideas, key people together to talk about how do we advance LGBT rights in the South and around the world.
So Tim, that means that this is both a museum, the Institute is both a museum and an activist group. How does that work?
Well, I wouldn't call it an activist group. I think it's certainly a community of people that are trying to align the very rich history of civil rights, in particular in the South, and connect it to larger civil and human rights discussions. And a lot of the ways that we'll be doing that is through, connecting efforts in research to advancing social justice and change in areas of education and employment, in areas of public health and wellness, and also in areas of like criminal justice and safety.
You know, you are an African-American person. We're on the radio. People mm-hmm. can't see you. And there has been a lot of tension at times between the African-American community and the LGBT community. There has been resentment among blacks anytime the LGBT tried to claim any portion of civil rights history. Mm-hmm. What has been that conversation? What has that conversation been like for you?
It's always ironic because when people talk about the tension between the African American community and the LGBT community, as somebody who embodies both of those identities, I find that a little awkward because there's no tension in my existence. And I think so often there's been a very deliberate wedge created to kind of heighten this tension between African Americans and LGBT.
Who's creating the wedge?
I think that there are people, certain people on the right that have a vested interest in creating tension between those two communities. And so, for example, 1 in 3 LGBT people in this country identify as people of color. But oftentimes when we talk about or when we show the LGBT community, you don't see that diversity. And so if someone is seeing an LGBTQ community represented as white gay men, for example, asking for rights, for a lot of blacks who've endured the struggle of civil rights, that seems a little bit, you know, off-putting that a seemingly privileged group of people are aligning themselves with wanting civil rights, as opposed to the broad diversity in the LGBT community that actually exists, right? And that a lot of people who are part of the LGBT community are people of color, are people who are low income, are people that are in families. And so I think, you know, part of our task at the LGBT Institute is to also, in terms of visibility, representation, to really show a broader portrait of who we are as a community than sometimes gets depicted in the media.
I wonder, Ryan, as you move forward, is the Supreme Court decision on marriage, is that sort of a pin in the history timeline? Like you can sort of say, okay, here's everything that happened up till this point. Is it that important?
It's definitely an important moment for the community. And it is something I think a lot of folks say that is a defining moment. But I think that and going back to what Timon was mentioning, there's so much more that needs to be talked about within the LGBT community, especially around intersections of identities, when we're talking about the fact that there are a disproportionate amount of LGBT folks who are at lower income simply because they have lack of access to workplaces that are supportive of them, transgender folks in particular. So there's a host of issues that I think we hope that the Institute can help provide a platform for, and in particular communities that don't often get a microphone.
Timon, what is the next battle? What's the next achievement for the LGBT community? I mean, we're about as completely tolerant of all sexualities as we are post-racial, right? That's not true. So,
right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what happens next?
Well, you know, I have a slight bias here as an educator. I think that one area, that has been overlooked, I think because of a lot of the attention and focus given to marriage equality, has been our schools and education. It's an institution that is educating so many people. And as a former educator, when you look at the number of states that can fire teachers who happen to come out or be out, when you look at also the academic and educational outcomes of students who are LGBT, highest truancy rates, highest dropout rates, and the bullying and the suicide rates are astronomical among this population. I think in terms of talking about schools that excel, that we have to begin to look at and not ignore the impact of building safer and classroom environments for the LGBT youth. And I think we do that because of the academic and educational outcomes. But it's also about creating a society of people, regardless of differences in beliefs, who understand what it means to be tolerant and affirming and to work together across differences. And I think the school is a primary place where that cultivation and that awareness can happen.
And do you think that colleges should consider the sexual identity of a student when they're considering admission?
Well, I think that colleges are looking for diverse student bodies. They're looking for student bodies that reflect the reality of what people might experience in their lives thereafter. And I think that orientation is becoming one of those things that colleges are saying, hey, you know, we want a student body that reflects lots of different kinds of diversity. An organization that I work with through my connection with Teach for America, Campus Pride, has been advocating for the inclusion of sexual orientation as a category that people can identify as. As a college admissions officer, we often got essays from students about their coming out stories as a way of talking about their resilience as high school students. And that's something that was often very much valued in the way that the experiences of someone who might be of a certain religious background or a certain athlete might be as well. So I just think it's part of the diversity that a lot of colleges are looking to fill, and in particular in areas of research and study where people just need to have that awareness of, like, what it means to be American, and our modernity includes a lot of different civil rights and issues. And so colleges want to prepare students to be equipped to be able to talk to them and respond to those issues.
You know, Ryan, one of the things the LGBT Institute is trying to do is reach the next generation. And I wonder, where's the disconnect, do you think? Because society has become more open about sexual orientation. There are things available, and yet we see so many kids who are horribly bullied and take their lives. LGBT students are in high school and younger are more likely to take their lives than almost any other group of kids. Where's the disconnect?
Well, I mean, while young people oftentimes find more folks on TV or in the movies that are LGBT that they can see, it doesn't always translate to real-world experiences that they experience in their own home when they're hearing anti-gay remarks from, you know, parents or families, for example. So there is that disconnect there, and I think that's what we're talking about, is that they're seeing that there's this opportunity out there, but it sometimes seems unreachable for them. But I will say what we have found just through the young people coming through the center itself, what we're finding is a lot of them want to talk about LGBT issues, and they're tying it to different movements as well. Huh. And so more and more they're starting to understand the interrelational dynamics that oppression amongst all groups play.
And Tim Emma, is this kind of what you were alluding to when you were talking about education?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in school environments, and one of the reasons I'm focused on educators as someone who taught for so many years is that when you're in a school environment, and as I experienced, a teacher says something disparaging to a gay or lesbian student, it gives those other students permission to tease, to make fun of. And so many of the incidents of bullying that we hear about in schools aren't just happening from peers. They're happening from adults, principals, teachers who are charged with creating safe environments for all kids. So for me, that presents a problem, and it's why I've been working with Teach for America to really do this work nationally to equip our teachers and our schools with the environments and the protocols for how to create safer environments for kids.
I want to play you this clip. Part of the oral history project with Georgia State University, they spoke with Burl Boykin, and he's talking here about the very first Pride March in Atlanta in 1971. There was only 125 people, but here he is.
And very few, if any, people joined in like they have on later marches. I mean, we didn't know the KKK was going to come gunning by and shoot us all down, yeah, like happened up in North Carolina with those people or not. Nothing happened adverse, and we had a successful rally meeting in the park and, you know, doing all the little political speeches that we did, only they were more authentic then, I think, than now.
So, Ryan, Georgia State University is part of the project, and they've recorded these oral history projects, and this audio is going to be available through the Institute. But over and over you hear this sort of surprise that there's not violence, that here they are in the heart of they're in the Deep South, and even back in the 1970s, there wasn't the KKK showing up. Is that relatively common in what you've seen?
Well, I think it also speaks to the South in terms of hospitality. I do think that there is a lot of that here, obviously, and I think that that's why when we talk about people coming out and when you see early activists, they are surprised. But I think, but pleased to know that their initial thoughts about growing up in the South or coming to the South, for the most part, were true. That people tend to treat each other with respect, and I think sometimes when you are willing to be obvious and vocal and out front about it, it actually makes people sit back and in some ways be surprised and just kind of take it all in. So I think maybe, especially in those first Pride marches, I think it was a lot of the community just kind of sitting back saying, wow, this is happening.
That was Ryan Romerman and Tim M. West of the LGBT Institute at Atlanta's Center for Civil and Human Rights. The Institute has preserved oral histories from the state of Georgia. Here's another voice in that series, Atlanta resident Winston Johnson. He shared his experience coming out to Coretta Scott King and asking her to support LGBT rights.
She said, Winston, I knew that you and Leon loved each other. And she said, I just feel real happy that you wanted to include me in your life in that way. And she was wonderful. I had tears in my eyes when I was talking to her. And I decided that if I could come out with Coretta King, I could certainly come out with all my siblings, and I did.
This month marks 2 years since same-sex couples got their legal right to marry nationwide, and we'd love to hear from you about that. Have you gotten married or come out because of marriage equality? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us at OST Talk. Just ahead, a woman's view of Ernest Hemingway, but first, school choice. What exactly does that mean? This is On Second Thought.
Looking for girls who are boys, who like boys, to be girls, who do boys like their girls, who do girls like their boys. Oh, I should be someone you really love. Girls who are boys, who like boys, to be girls, who do boys like their girls, who do girls.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is an aggressive proponent of school choice. Here she is during her confirmation hearing.
Parents no longer believe that a one-size-fits-all model of learning meets the need of every child, and they know other options exist, whether magnet, virtual, charter, home, faith-based, or any other combination.
But her definition of school choice may not be the same as the senator's or yours. The fact is, school choice is one of those phrases that gets thrown around a lot, but it is often misunderstood, and that means it's time to break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
At its
its simplest, school choice simply means educational alternatives to public grade schools. The part that gets complicated is what those alternatives are and how we pay for them. For what it's worth, this argument over school choice is not a new one. For centuries, children have missed classes or even left school altogether to help their parents on farms or in family businesses.
The day of the worker who works from home is here. We need to unionize. We have the right to work at home in peace without interruptions.
Remember, Congress didn't pass the Fair Labor Standards Act until 1938. In the 19th century, it was fairly common for children to work 50 to 70 hour weeks, so schooling was not part of their daily lives.
Security lies in business and white collar work. Ted sees his father's point of view and agrees. And so, that's the kind of job he'll look for.
The first public high school in America opened its doors in 1821 in Boston. By the time the 20th century rolled in, public schools outnumbered private for the first time. But it wasn't until 1945 that most kids in the South went past the eighth grade. So public education and standardized education are still in the experimental phase.
What's that?
Experiments.
Asparagus.
Experiments.
Experiments.
Right.
The concept of giving parents control over what their children learn in school is a really old one. The great British philosopher John Stuart Mill wrote in 1869 that the government should stay out of arguments over curriculum.
The government should leave to parents to obtain the education where and how they please, and content itself with helping to pay the school fees of the poorer classes of children and defraying the entire school expenses of those who have no one else to pay for them.
Originally, compulsory education was supported by the Ku Klux Klan. America at that time was gripped by a fear of Catholics in 1920. Many people wanted to shield their kids from parochial education. Historian William Ross described a leaflet that the KKK distributed as showing, quote, a grinning, torch-wielding Catholic bishop triumphantly departing from a burning public schoolhouse whose teacher rang the school bell one last time as he lay dying in the vestibule, mourned by crying children, end quote. But laws requiring kids to attend public schools were struck down in the higher courts. Then, anti-Catholic sentiment rose again in the 1940s. Many people didn't want the Catholic Church to get tax dollars to support its schools. In 1947, the Supreme Court decided the Everson v. Board of Education case. It drew a clear line between religious schools and public funds. Since then, that line has been erased quite a bit. Now, the debate has swung the other way. Many people want to be able to send their kids to private schools and religious schools, but still enjoy a free or subsidized educational system. There are a number of models in use right now that come under the label school choice. In 14 states, including Georgia, school choice means the state provides a scholarship or a stipend so students can go learn where they want, including private schools. And in some places, that's called a voucher. Magnet schools are sometimes included in this category. These are places that focus on particular subjects like science or music, but they're still part of the public school system. Homeschooling is also part of school choice. But the most controversial option is charter schools. Here's Fox News analyst John Stossel.
Those great new charter schools we showed you, I just wish there were more of them, more competition, because competition makes everybody better.
But not everyone is sold on the charter school system. We've seen demonstrations across the country.
Charter schools are not public schools. Charter schools are not public schools.
Charter schools are part of the public school system, but they're not bound by the same regulations as public schools. They have a lot more flexibility in what they teach and whom they hire. The debate over charter schools is further complicated by research that shows kids in most of those schools do no better or worse than those in traditional public schools. We're talking about school choice, and so it's preferable that we bring in someone who actually knows a little bit more about the ins and outs of that system. And then we have Atlanta Journal-Constitution education editor Christopher Quinn with us. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Did we get everything basically right?
Well, I'm going to have to contend with you on a couple of things. One is that the more controversial issue right now is charter schools. Charters have been part of the Georgia landscape for more than a decade now. And like the lead-in you said, or like the lead-in you gave said, you know, they are doing no more better, no more worse than most of our public schools. And they are part of the public school system. It's tax dollars that support those. But what really is controversial and more controversial are the vouchers that you talked about. That's where you take public tax dollars that were set aside for your kid to educate your kid in public school systems, and you can send those dollars to a private school. That could be a parochial school. That could be the Baptist school down the church or down the road, or it can be like a big private school that does really good, like Padilla or Walker School here in Atlanta.
Although the reason we talk about the controversy surrounding charter schools is because there have been a number of headline-making scandals. There was a series of scandals in Ohio, for example. There was a scandal here where a charter school director was accused of embezzling money. There was a $249 million grant to charter schools announced the day that Arne Duncan resigned. That became a pretty big, ugly scandal as well. While charter schools, their results may be no better or no worse than public schools, they seem to have a fair share of ugly headlines.
Yeah, and I think that comes from some of the freedoms we give them. We gave charter schools more freedom and less oversight, or supposedly less oversight, from a public official such as your local school board or even a state official in order to try to get them to get better results. We give them these freedoms so that they can experiment and try things to try to get better results. That's the heart of the charter system. But with that freedom, obviously, comes some problems. So here in Atlanta, you mentioned the one where the former director of the charter school had filched money from the school. That guy's facing those charges now. Had he had better oversight from his school board, and each charter school has a school board within the school, so it's not part of the local school board that's overseeing the charter school. It's the members, families, and friends of that charter school form their own little school board. And that case obviously didn't have the oversight necessary, the financial oversight, to catch that early on and stop it before hundreds of thousands of dollars went missing. So, yes, that happens because, I think, of the freedoms that we give charter schools to experiment and try things. And sometimes what we haven't done as well is provide proper oversight to keep those types of things from happening.
I should also point out, Christopher, that while I was talking about the statistics that show charter schools are end up getting results no better or no worse than public schools. We got a tweet from our own Grant Blankenship, who points out that charter schools in the state of Georgia are among the lowest performing schools in the state. So even results among charter schools vary pretty widely.
They do. And you have to keep in mind there are two types of charter schools. There are startup charter schools, which is what we typically think of as charters. That's where a group of families and parents, along with some sort of implementer, like a for-profit or a nonprofit school system, come in and they create a whole new school in your system. And that's a public school, though. You can apply to have your kid go there. And then there are charter systems like Decatur City Schools, which have declared themselves, with state's approval, charter schools. And they get certain freedoms as well to operate as a system with more freedom from state regulation. But it's the pop-up charter schools where you see the results are down a couple of points on one of our main measures of how our students are doing, and that's the College and Career Readiness Performance Index. We see that the standalone charter schools that are not part of the charter systems score right now a couple of points down. I think it's about just 77, and then charters, the standalone charter schools are down about 75 or so in their score. So, yeah. And there are a lot of good reasons and arguments about why that's the case that aren't clearly enough understood, because some charter schools do great and some charter schools do really poorly. But overall, you see them down a couple of points lower than the state average, and we really need some good research to sort of figure out why that is the case so that we can find those charter schools that really work well and recreate those systems and leave the ones that are failing behind.
I'm talking about school choice with Atlanta Journal-Constitution education editor Christopher Quinn. And one of the reasons we're talking about the Christopher is because Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is a real supporter of school choice. Which kind of school choice does she support?
Well, she supports both charters and vouchers. Again, vouchers is where your public tax dollars can be sent to a private school. And that's where she really made her chops, is not as a school administrator or a teacher, but as a political proponent of charter schools and voucher schools. And she really has supported a lot of candidates over the last few years. Of course, she comes from wealth on both sides. Her husband's family and she are both very wealthy, and she has given $5 million, excuse me, in the last 5 years to political candidates that were really sort of high on the issues of charters and vouchers. And you see what's happened in Michigan, where she really had a voice, which is where she's from. And it has some of the, I think, Detroit, where she's really had a hand in helping.
Those results were not good, though.
No. You see really, really poor results in Detroit and also in Michigan, which has so many charter operators that there are 25 or more groups and agencies who can qualify charter schools and say, yes, you can start a charter school. Here in Georgia, there are two. That's your local school system and the state chartering authority. And so with fewer people having oversight of who can start a charter and who can't, I think we have better quality charter schools, obviously, than they had in Michigan, which had been have had really poor results.
But how much control does the Secretary of Education have over what school my kid goes to and how that school is administered?
The State Secretary of Education doesn't have a lot of authority over where you send your kid. If you live, it's state laws lay out, you know, if you live in a school district, that's where you have to send your kid unless you send them to a private school or a charter school. And we hear occasionally of those cases where kids want to play football at a better school, it has a better football team, so they'll cross district lines. And, of course, when that's found out, those parents can be fined pretty heftily for sending their kids outside of the school system. So it's not really the State Secretary of Education that has control of that. That's pretty much set up through Georgia law and regulation.
What are the other parts of school choice? Because school choice means something different to everyone else. And we've talked about charter schools, which mm-hmm. is often referred to. We've talked about vouchers. But there mm-hmm. are other portions of school choice that are also included in that title, like homeschooling is part yep. of school choice, is it not?
It is. So you can homeschool. And there are also virtual academies here in Georgia where your child, your student, goes online to attend classes virtually and does the homework online. Virtually, and there are quite a few thousand students doing that. The beauty of that is that if you're in Coffee County, your kid can, you know, attend one of the Georgia Virtual Academies that may be based out of Gwinnett County or out of here in Atlanta. So it's truly open to kids everywhere, which is not true for charter schools. If you look at where charter schools are located, they're clustered in metro areas and mostly in North Georgia. A lot of rural counties and other counties sort of out of the way. They don't have access to the actual charter school, but they do have access to a virtual charter school. But again, results there have been generally poorer than in public schools. So there's the virtual academies, there's charter schools, there are private schools, there's homeschooling, and then there is the voucher-like system that Georgia has set up now. It's called the Student Scholarship Organizations that are supported by tax credits given to people or businesses who send their money to one of these scholarshiping organizations, which is a nonprofit. The scholarship organization sends it to the school that you designate, and then that school gives out scholarships to public kids, and they can be private schools. So you can have, you know, again, say a Padilla Academy accepting students under these scholarship organizations. There's some good stuff and bad stuff about that. The critics don't like it in that it's really a system set up where we really don't know how those public dollars are being spent or what the results are for the students, because private schools don't have to report student results like public schools do.
Yeah, it's impossible to track. We have a tweet from a listener, Adam Dean, who says, aren't vouchers basically an upward redistribution of wealth? Is that fair?
Well, it's hard to say here in Georgia, and there's this to think about. So most really high-quality private schools cost a lot of money. I was looking last night just to sort of check my facts on this, and, you know, you can pay $25,000 a year to send your kid to a private school here in Atlanta. That's, you know, 10th grade, 11th grade. And say you get one of these state vouchers, one of these scholarships, that may be worth $6,000 or $8,000. Well, if you're a working class guy making $45,000 a year, that $6,000 is not going to help you pay that $25,000 bill. You're probably not going to be able to do that. So I think that there is an advantage for people who are already sending their kids and can afford to send their kids to expensive private schools, and that they can all of a sudden get this tax break that they weren't getting before for doing that. So that is the critic's argument, is that that's true, that it really helps the wealthy, and the poor and working class people won't be able to take advantage of these scholarships like the upper class as well.
Yeah, that tuition is twice what it costs to send my son to Georgia State. Anyhow, that's Atlanta Journal-Constitution education editor Christopher Quinn. Christopher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Just ahead, from Kansas City star to international fame, a new biography covers the rise of Ernest Hemingway. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We just talked about the role of school choice in Georgia. Tomorrow, we'll continue this look at the future of education in our state. A new report says schools in 11 southern states, including Georgia, are resegregating. We'll find out what's going on. First, we want to hear your concerns about education where you live. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Honored among America's most famous novelists, Ernest Hemingway told a lot of stories, but his life had a generous share of stories as well. Mary Dearborn is the author of a new biography titled simply Ernest Hemingway. It hit the shelves last month and is the first biography of Ernest Hemingway written by a female. She joins me now. Hi there, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Now, there are a number of firsts your publisher has identified about the book. One is that you're the first female biographer. The other is that this is the first look at some unearthed material. What's included in that material?
Well, when Hemingway and his wife had to flee Cuba in 1959 after Castro came in, they left in a hurry, and there were a lot of papers left there moldering in the basement. Everything else, too, his furniture. It was all his books. They were all given to the Cuban people, not willingly, I don't think. But those papers have slowly been coming out, or rather, they are now in this country, but they were being digitized immediately. His medical records are there in quite some detail. And his wife's papers, all of those are out now. Every piece of paper from the Finca Vigia, his Havana hilltop retreat, is now in this country, but they're all digitized, and there's a tremendous amount of new information in them.
Well, we're going to spend the next few minutes parsing out what you have learned that is new, but let's start with what you found in relation to how he became sort of a stereotype in his own lifetime. He became iconic while still living. That's something that doesn't usually happen until somebody has passed away. And it came almost immediately after A Sun Also Rises was published. Why do you think that occurred?
Well, he was already a legend in the 30s, but The Sun Also Rises, that had supposedly one writer joke that everybody was dropping out of college to sit on the left bank at cafes and wear berets after they read The Sun Also Rises. He had enormous charm, and he was in Paris, and he knew the whole expatriate community, and they just adored him. And this crept into the coverage of him. He was really one of the first celebrities. As early as 1935, I think, Vanity Fair published a page that was paper dolls of Ernest Hemingway, and the doll himself had a caveman's skin on with a club, and the outfits were of a bullfighter, a soldier, and a marlin fisherman. So that's pretty early to be made into a legend, enough of a legend that there are paper dolls made of you.
What was the source of his charisma? I mean, when he was in Paris as quite a young man, he was described as being the golden young man there. And people were often commenting on how charming and charismatic and gregarious he was. What was the source of that?
Well, he was enormously good looking, for one thing. If you see the pictures of him in the early 20s. But the looks obviously came from his family, and so did the charisma that went along with him. His mother was a really remarkable woman, multi-talented, with incredible energy. And she, like Hemingway, was said to, if she entered a room, she sucked all the air out of it. Everybody looked to her. And they were physically similar. She was quite bulky, not really overweight, but big. And he was massive in his 30s, 40s. And really, the charisma came from her. He was going to leave a mark. It was quite clear. He never considered that he wouldn't become a famous writer. So it's the self-confidence, a lot of energy, a lot of curiosity, and ability to make you feel like you were special. He was just really good one-on-one, not always so good if it was behind your back.
But since you mentioned his mother, Grace, Hemingway famously wrote about her. Quote, I hate her guts and she hates mine. She forced my father to suicide. He didn't attend her funeral. He didn't have a lot of love for his mother. How did that end up affecting his relationship, do you think, with other women? I mean, we're talking about a writer who's often used as an example of sexist.
Well, two things, really. One is that he did not hate his mother until late in life, and really until his father's suicide in 1928. And let's see, Hemingway was around then, 28, 29. And it was, and even so, he was in constant contact with her. He sent her money, he supported her, and so forth. But, and as a young boy, adolescent, and even as a young man, 18 or 19, he loved his mother. It was a very close-knit family. But after he came back from World War I and around 1918, his mother had a lesbian affair with a girl who had been a sort of au pair in the Hemingway household. She'd been a voice student of Grace's. Grace taught voice. And the family really came apart at this. But after it threatened to fall apart. But after this incident, Grace went on to live with this woman for the rest of her life. Ernest, for example, was just fine with lesbians. In fact, he had a lifelong fondness for lesbians. And there are a whole range of them, from his sister-in-law to Gertrude Stein, and she's an interesting example because she looks a lot like Grace and Ernest, this same big, massive, and some of the same qualities. So I think that his early love for his mother persisted, and he felt it was incumbent on him to hate his mother more than I think he actually did.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Mary Dearborn. She's the author of a new biography about novelist Ernest Hemingway. The elephant in the room, not to quote any Ernest Hemingway stories, but the elephant in the room is his relationship with women. And that's what makes it remarkable that you, a female, are writing a biography of Ernest Hemingway, a man who has been loathed and loved by feminists. And I'll read some bits of quotes, the ones that have been the most offensive to feminists throughout the years. There's an early story he wrote called Soldier's Home, and a quote from that is, when you were really ripe for a girl, you always got one. You didn't have to think about it. His third wife said, a man must be a very great genius to make up for being such a loathsome human being. And the one quote that people seem to return to over and over was something he wrote about F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife. He claimed that she ruined him, and he says at the end,
If you leave a woman, though, you probably ought to shoot her. It would save enough trouble in the end, even if they hanged you. What did you learn, or what do you think is the truth about Ernest Hemingway and his relationship to women?
I think those are great quotes to pull out, and they're very damning. And I think he was, women, the idea of women, a whole, you know, gender, did not offend him as much as I think those quotes imply. He was just kind of mean to people, and he was mean to his wives. And there's a reputation, he has a reputation as a womanizer. You know, he was married four times, and it goes along with being a sportsman, a fisherman, a macho legend. But he was not a womanizer, for example. I think that I have no way of knowing, but I would estimate that he slept with about six women maybe total in his lifetime. That's including the wives. I'm not defending him. He could be really awful to them, but he could also be really awful to anyone. And there's among sort of Hemingway student scholars, there's and a lot of readers, an accusation that he was unable to create believable female characters. And I don't think that's right. And I think that some of his stories, like Hills Like White Elephants, which is seems to be about a young man, it's convincing the woman with him to have an abortion. There's a sensitivity in it that you don't find in a guy that has a blanket hatred of women. I don't think that that's his biggest failing, I'll put it that way.
So that begs the question, what is his biggest failing? Is it that you outline in your book a sort of simmering rage inside him and suggest that that may be a part of what drove him? It was that his failing?
I don't know. He didn't really, he didn't understand himself very well. And he acted inconsistently, and he would... One onlooker, Donald Ogden Stewart, said that, you know, sometimes he'd start treating you badly and it really wasn't anything. It was just a mood that he was in. And I think he was a really fascinating human being with a lot of good things about him. I admire him, even though I consider myself a feminist, but he was mean to people. And sometimes it seemed out of nowhere. And in fact, the people that he was meanest to were people who had helped him anyway. So I think that his treatment of women is all of a piece with that.
So how are we to reconcile the hyper-macho, masculine adventure man who went on all those safaris and walked on the balls of his feet in order to appear a couple inches taller with the guy who wrote love letters that could only be described as squelchy? Baby talk, pillow talk, sweet nothings, pet names. He called them kitty cat and sweet feathered kitten.
Yes, he did.
How do we reconcile those two sides of him?
Well, the side of him that's macho and hyper male and a sportsman and a fisherman and so forth, that's not real, or that's, he did a lot of those things, but the legend that sprang up really has very little to do with him. He was a really, here's some of the better side of him. He was a really vulnerable, easily wounded, sensitive, new age guy, not new age, but he was sensitive, and he could be very loving. This mean streak could come out of nowhere. Maybe Donald Ogden Stewart is right that it just happened when he was in a mood. I'm not saying you'd want to be married to him, though.
From all reports, being married to him was awful.
Well, the first wife it wasn't, and the first two wives it really wasn't. Hadley, you know, he left Hadley, and he chose to make that into a terrible story. But they had been very happy, and his marriage to Pauline was really happy. In fact, it's a complicated marriage. She really gave up everything for him. But for his writing, that was her biggest priority, was to let him write. But then the third wife, Martha Gellhorn, came along and really stole Ernest away from Pauline. I mean, he had to have been ready to leave. But he didn't treat Martha. Martha and he gave as good as they got to each other. And the fourth wife, Mary, was in the most unfortunate position because she really had to become his caretaker. And he got more abusive and mean as he got older and sicker.
Before we go, what is the fascination with Ernest Hemingway? Why are we still writing biographies about him and studying him and doing documentaries? Why can't we get enough of him?
It seems like he returns. I mean, there's not been a biography of him since 1995, a full biography. But we do seem to need Hemingway. Almost every generation needs a different Hemingway. And I think personally it's because of the work. I think that work is stuff is people can read it and connect to it in a way you can't with any other writer. Much as in many ways I think Gatsby is better than anything Ernest wrote.
The Great Gatsby. Yeah.
Yes. I think that... You know, a lot of people read him in school, and teachers love him because he teaches himself. You know, that it's there in the stories, and you do realize, the students realize that there's feelings beneath the surface of what is said in the story, and that's his iceberg formulation of his own work, that all you see is the tip of the iceberg, but there's all this stuff below the ocean surface that's informing what you see, and it's bigger than what you see. So I think that works on people, on anyone who reads them. I also think, just briefly, that the culture seems to have a need for a super macho, bullfighting, you know, Marlon wrestling, shooting, boxing, hyper male kind of myth. And I don't know. And I obviously try to undo that myth about, I think the strength that I have as a woman is I don't have any investment in that legend. I don't really care. Or as I say in my book, it's not what I bring to the book is, I'm sure I have my own baggage, but it's not an investment in that legend, which I think marred all the previous biographies, and all of which were written by men.
That is Mary Dearborn, author of the new biography, Ernest Hemingway. She is in Atlanta tonight for a book signing at the Margaret Mitchell House at 7 p.m. Mary, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. Who is your favorite author? Maybe it's Ernest Hemingway. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us or post on our Facebook page. For today, it's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley.